Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we're going to talk about equity crowdfunding, which has been recently passed by Congress and the Obama administration in the Jobs Act. And what we're waiting on now is for the SEC to put rules around that. But equity crowdfunding has been touted as the most meaningful change to the securities law since the 1930s. And why that is, it allows the average person to invest in startups and new businesses. Today, only 1% of the population is allowed to do that, and that's accredited investors and investing institutions. But this act will allow the average person to invest in startups, and that is a welcome change to the 98% of startups and entrepreneurs that cannot find funds to fund their business. They just don't get the backing by the institutions and by the venture capital companies. So the thought of this act is to democratize investing, and it has the potential of really allowing startups to flourish and to create a whole new atmosphere in our country as far as getting businesses to grow and get going. So it'll be a welcome change, and it'll be interesting to see how this goes. But today we're going to bring on two experts in this field, Philip Cardwell, who is the CEO and founder of Crowdfunding Accelerator, and Paul Winkle of Alex Consulting.
Hi, Philip and Paul. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Sarah. This is Philip. It's good to be back. Thanks for having me again.
Hey, Sarah. Paul, nice to meet you.
Yeah, glad you guys are here. I wanted to have you back, as you know, because we talked about the regular traditional crowdfunding, and we had such an informational session. And we wanted to have you back to talk about the equity crowdfunding, because I know that's new. It's come through Congress, and it's not legal everywhere yet, and you're going to have to fill us in on what that means. But before we get into all that, will you two let listeners know what your background is?
Yeah, sure. And this is Philip, Sarah, and we've known each other for a while now. Paul and I have known each other for well over a decade. Currently, I'm co-founder of Crowdfunding Accelerator. Got into crowdfunding many years ago when we all thought that equity crowdfunding was going to come around rather quickly. Due to the Securities Exchange Commission dragging their feet, as usual, we ended up needing to set that aside and move into the more traditional crowdfunding so far as campaign management, marketing and advertising and such. And that's kind of my history with Paul. Right now we're working together on the equity crowdfunding side of things.
And Sarah, this is Paul Winkle. Philip, I think we've known each other a little bit longer than that. You know, time does slip by in a hurry. But I've been
That's
taking.
That's because we're all getting old.
I wasn't going to bring up.
We don't want to admit that.
To me, it sounds better to say a couple of, you know, maybe a decade or so. The reality of it's probably more like two.
Anyway, I have a company called Alex Consulting that provides turnkey solutions for small companies wanting to go public on the OTC markets. And prior to that, I started my career in 1983 as a stockbroker. I went through investment banking, working for some larger firms. And also, I have some mergers and acquisitions background. But for the last 17 years or so, I've been helping companies in that capacity, have a complete working group assembled, soup to nuts, to be able to take a company public.
Okay, that's great. So you both have a wonderful background for this topic. So let's get into the equity crowdfunding. Where did the idea come from and what's going on? Well, first of all, let's talk about where the idea came from, and then I want to get on to where it is in Congress.
Philip, I'll take that one. Quite simply put, Sarah, the markets needed a better way for small companies to raise capital to be able to grow. So on April 5th of 2012, the Jumpstart Our Business Act was enacted into law. It's called the Jobs Act. And this was the first major change to the securities laws since 1934. So just to give you an idea of how the regulators really don't like change, And that's one of the reasons there's been a little bit of resistance, I think, to actually getting this pushed through, is because of the resistance to change. But they have adopted some new rules, but until they're officially released, any offers or sales of securities purporting to rely on the crowdfunding exemption would be unlawful under federal securities laws. Philip will get into state securities laws a little bit later. But in October of 2013, the SEC did promulgate some rules that would govern crowdfunding, and the final rules are expected to take effect sometime late next year is what I'm hearing.
Are there specific things or people that are against it? Is there a general... I mean, there's a general consensus of being for crowdfunding, equity crowdfunding, but is there any strong lobby against it?
Well, there is. I mean, from the standpoint, this is Philip again, but yeah, from the standpoint of any time, you know, you look at throwing the status quo up against the wall, so to speak, you have those parties that are going to object to it for two reasons, one of which is out of fear of what it could bring along with it, in this case, fraud. And the other is out of how it may affect their bottom line on the business that they're doing right now. We know, as we spoke before, that part of the reason that we have this delay, and it was mandated by Congress that the SEC go ahead and clear this up long ago, they're over 2 years late now, but part of the reason we have this delay was that the head of the SEC at the time had made the decision that crowdfunding had the potential to be so ripe with fraud that she did not want her name or her legacy possibly tainted as being the person who set the rules and finally okayed crowdfunding when, you know, it turns into one big, you know, one
quagmire
big
and
theft
everybody.
Ring, so
yeah,
to speak.
So the people against it are the ones that are afraid of change, afraid that we're not going to get it set up right at first. And then there's also are the big financial companies, were they for it or against it? You know,
well,
like the Goldman Sachs and the Morgan Stanleys of the world.
I think you're actually going to find, well, number one, when something comes so far and it develops such a foothold as equity crowdfunding is, they start to understand, and I'm referring to the large institutions, that it's kind of the old, if you can't beat them, join them. So I think that particularly some of the banks are beginning to understand that, look, you know, this is coming whether we like it or not, and we might as well figure out a way to get involved and be a part of it.
Okay. Well, that'll be interesting to see how they all jump in, and I want to get back to that a little bit later and what you think that's going to entail. But before we get into the details of the big banks being involved, what is the difference, would you say, between equity crowdfunding and regular crowdfunding?
Oh, that's a great question, Sarah. This is Paul. I'll Philip, if you don't mind, I'll start off on that one. Crowdfunding is not like fundraising on sites that perhaps your listeners are familiar with, like Kickstarter and Indiegogo. So there's a significant difference in the relationship between the contributors who give you money on these type of fundraising sites and investors who are purchasing stock or loaning you money, you know, once it's legally permitted. So the best way to look at it is you have absolutely the issuer or the company raising the money has no legal relationship or obligation to a contributor on one of those fundraising sites. But you do have a direct legal obligation to a shareholder on a crowdfunding site. So that's the major significant difference. So if you're selling them equity like common stock, they become stockholders. It's got many implications under the law of the state in which your company is incorporated. And for example, if you're selling them debt, you become, the investor becomes almost like a bank where you're obligated to pay that money back.
Okay.
I would agree with him in everything that he said. I mean, put quite simply, though, if you want to contrast it to what we refer to as that donation model when people think of Kickstarter and Indiegogo, and of course, that's where people are soliciting funding, you know, and in return, they're expecting something, a product, a T-shirt, a pre-release CD, you know, something that's made for an Apple iPhone, something like that. But that's all they get. After that, you know, the campaign is over. It's ended. They're done. There's no more relationship. As Paul just mentioned, when you get into equity crowdfunding, you're actually becoming a business owner, so to speak, through the equity side of it, of that company, and there's going to be a long-term relationship there.
So it's like owning a timeshare.
Yeah.
You know, in a way.
Let's hope that it works out a lot better than the timeshares did.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, so would you approach it differently? Could Indiegogo be set up to do equity crowdfunding?
At this point, they have no intention of doing that. As I said a few minutes ago, you're going to find that old adage that if you can't beat them, join them. And it makes sense. When you have someone who's already entrenched with a name in crowdfunding, be it donation or whatever you want to call it, you know, it would make sense for them to get into that. On the other hand, you could contrast that or compare it, I should say, to a bank. There are some things, or even better yet, a car dealership or a car manufacturer. When you're good at something and you do something well and you're making money off of it, sometimes you don't necessarily want to rock the boat or change your business model and take a chance. For example, you know, I don't know of any car manufacturers out there who also own tire plants. Even though we know that every car sold needs new tires throughout the history of the car, it's easier and better off for them to rely on an entirely different industry taking care of that side of the business. So I don't think you're going to see right now any of those groups that are going to jump into the equity crowdfunding side of it.
And that's because dealing with equity and dealing with the financial part is going to be a lot more work, and you have to have a lot of expertise to do that. Whereas now it's not that big of a deal.
Part of it, they certainly have the ability to come up with that expertise very quickly because they have been involved in the industry, even though in a different sense, for quite a while. But I think what you're going to find is they're making so much money off of the business model that they have right now that, you know, they're going to think long and hard before they make a decision whether or not to attempt to even play with that.
And there's going to be greater legal responsibilities as well, too, if they decide to jump into the equity part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they got to do it right. And the software needs to be written in a way that, I mean, I would think there's just a lot of details that you could mess up one thing and then you're liable.
You know, you're right about that, but when it comes to that, you mentioned software, for instance. I mean, there are some people who have really been on the forefront of the entire equity crowdfunding movement. You've got securities lawyers like Doug Elinoff. You've got Representative Patrick McHenry, who has helped, you know, propose bills that have addressed the issue and really has pushed this through from the beginning. You have Ruth Hedges, who has been instrumental in keeping this out there. I mean, she consistently, once a year, she runs these conferences out in Las Vegas, and she actually developed a software a couple of years ago that is designed to help people through the process of the accounting side of it should they determine that they want to use equity crowdfunding. So there are a lot of people out there who've been working at this for a long time, and without their help and without their, you know, continuing to push and educate people on this, you know, we wouldn't be where we are now.
Well, would you approach it the same way as regular crowdfunding, or would you need to approach it differently? Because I know in our last conversation, we talked a lot about how to ensure success, and it was like looking at it as if you were doing a campaign. Now, would you approach this differently, or would
you... And this is Philip again, and you know, we did talk about that, and there are certain similarities and there are certain differences. I mean, there's one thing that's going to hold true, or a couple of things actually, to both forms of crowdfunding. And that is that, you know, you look at crowdfunding very much as a give and a get scenario. In other words, if someone's giving you their money, and whether it be equity crowdfunding or donation-based crowdfunding, they expect to get something in return. Now, in the traditional side of it, what they expect in return is a hard item, and we've talked about that. On the equity side of it, though, what they expect in return is to make money. They want a return on their investment. And if you're looking to show someone the possible return on their investment, then approaching it differently is a big deal. And what I mean by that is now you need to flip sides and you need to look at it as if you were trying to sell any other type of investment to an investor. They're more concerned with the actual numbers, with the safety of the deal, whether or not the likelihood that that return is going to come back to them, what length period of time. It's, as we said earlier, it's an ongoing long-term relationship, and you need to address those issues in the beginning before you know whether or not
And
someone is going to be interested.
Wouldn't you say realistically it's going to be a little bit larger sums? Because people aren't as interested. Let's say they put in $10. They're really not all that interested knowing that they're going to double their money in 3 years when it's $10.
Oh, no question. Well, I think, you know, to take it a step further, if you're probably familiar with the show Shark Tank, I mean, you will notice that sometimes that people, when you get to that certain level as an investor, it may be a great deal or a great return on investment. It's simply that it's too small. You don't want to deal with something that's that small. You're looking at things that are much, much larger. So absolutely, you're correct in saying that.
Well, yeah, and somebody who has $100 million would be like $10 to, you know, $100,000 to somebody with $100 million is like $10 to the regular person. And it's just not... You don't care if you make $20 in the next 3 years.
Well, that's right. And that's normally why you'll find, you know, in your venture capital deals. I mean, you know, those guys don't like to even look at things that are anywhere less than $3 to $5 million, which, you know, I think is another reason why you're going to see equity crowdfunding. You'll see the venture capital group get involved, but most of the deals are going to be of such a small nature that you may have people that are involved in venture capital get involved individually into equity crowdfunding deals. But not collectively as a group.
They won't get involved as their company because their company needs $3 to $5 million deals. But as an individual investor themselves, they might do it because, you know, $10,000 might be a chunk of money to them.
Right. Right. Okay. And these deals are going to be, I mean, the amount, by the time the rules come out and everything, the amount that people are going to be allowed to invest is going to be, you know, so small compared to what someone of that caliber would be looking at, that it's really going to, you know, like I said, unless they want to address it individually, it's out of the equation.
Well, that keeps it safer too, a little bit, I would think, from having the big companies come in and take over.
Well, it keeps from muddying the water, so to speak, and it also stands true to what the whole idea is behind this, which is to allow smaller groups of people, much larger demographically, but smaller groups of people to come in and participate. And you have to go back to the beginning, too, when this whole thing was put into effect. The idea behind the Jobs Act was to create jobs. And so as a result of that, to make finances easier for new and upcoming entrepreneurs and businesses to get their hands on, the idea was that, well, where are they going to get it? If they can't go to the bank and they can't go to a VC group or something like that, then we need to address that by having your everyday mom and pop be able to invest small sums if they feel like it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it just opens up the doors for people to be able to get money a different way. Well, it's not legal yet. So what can people do now? And what are the restrictions?
Well, I'll start off with that one, Philip. Right now, let's go back a little bit here. There are some rules that have changed within the Jobs Act. While we're waiting for equity crowdfunding under Title III of the Jobs Act to be approved to use, Title II has been approved. So let's go back a little bit here. Prior to the Jobs Act, I'm sure you've heard of this before, Sarah, where startup businesses or businesses are looking to grow, really they go to, you know, family, friends, and credit cards. They're bootstrapping.
Yeah.
Their business. So the rules were, unless you had a prior relationship with an investor, and there's really no definition of that, it basically states that you cannot raise money from somebody you don't have a substantive relationship with. That's the actual terminology that the SEC uses. So you can only go to friends, family, and tap your credit cards to be able to do that. But you could do it under a private placement under Regulation D of the Act. And one of the most popular ones under that of raising money is a 506. There's actually 9 different parts to Regulation D, 3 of which allow you to raise money in different increments. The most popular by far is Rule 506. So here's what's changed in Title II. In 2014,
so what is Rule 506?
Rule 506 comes under Regulation D, private placement. So it allows companies to raise money under private placements. And there are certain rules and regulations that you must follow as far as filing paperwork to be able to raise that money. But until the Jobs Act was approved under Title II for a different type of 506, the only way a company, which is called an issuer, the SEC calls them issuers, could raise money is from people that they had a prior existing relationship with. Like I said, there's really no definition
to
that.
Okay, so that's what 506 is. Okay.
That's what 506 is. So they want you to have known this investor for X amount of months or years before even mentioning an opportunity to invest in your company.
Okay, so what's new?
Well, here's what's new. In 2014, the SEC made it possible for small businesses wishing to raise money in that 506 offering that I just mentioned to use general solicitation and advertising. That is huge. First change since 1934. So what they're basically saying is a company, an issuer, can go out and actually raise money from investors that they don't have a prior relationship with.
So if you need $100,000, I can get 100 people to give me $1,000.
Well, you could actually do it that way, but of course there is a catch.
Okay, what's the catch?
The new rule that's under Title II of the Jobs Act, that's called Rule 506C, as in Charlie. It limits companies using the rule to only accept investments from accredited investors.
Oh, so you can't get your neighbor down the street who doesn't have $1 million and you got to say what an accredited investor is, but they can't give me $1,000.
If you're relying, you can do that under friends and family if you've known them a long time.
Well, they're a neighbor, but let's say they're a neighbor like 5 miles away.
Oh, come on, Sarah. I know where you live. You'd have plenty of neighbors that could contribute.
But you know what I'm saying? So basically, they have to be accredited. Now, you need to tell people what it means to be accredited.
Absolutely. And let me just say one other thing first, too. But not only do they have to be accredited, but here's what's new. The companies that are raising money must also take reasonable steps to verify that they're accredited investors. So, Sarah, before, all the accredited investor needed to do was fill out a self-authenticating form, check the boxes saying that they're an accredited investor, and they're off and running. Now you have to jump through hoops to be able to get it done, but it's not that difficult. So you want to know what the basic definition of an accredited investor is. There's many different definitions, but just a quick definition to kind of, this is what most people out there that are looking to raise money would be relying on. It's any natural person who has an individual net worth or that joint with their spouse at the time that they're making the purchase of $1 million or more. One of the changes to the definition of accredited investor is you can no longer include the equity in your home primary residence. So before you could, now you can't. So before you could just have them check a box, I'm accredited, maybe they are, maybe they're not, and they can include their residence in there, now you can't. That's one change that has occurred.
Put that in perspective. In 2013 in the U.S., there were around 8.6 million that were considered accredited investors.
Good point.
So there's quite a bit. But what? There's not as many as people who can invest $1,000, right? I mean,
well,
once it opens up to – and you can't – even if it's a certain threshold of money, like a little bit – $1,000, you can't.
See
is that part of the new act? Go ahead.
Well, that's right, but that's why I said in the last time that we talked about crowdfunding was that it does make a big difference, because now that's the big holdup. This is where this equity crowdfunding is either going to be the greatest thing that's happened in 100 years, or it's going to fall flat. One of the issues. The other is the cost of actually pulling it off as a company. But the issue that we're speaking to now is that instead of opening up yourself to 8.6 million people, if you are allowed, and we are, to solicitation out there to the world, and instead of only relying on those possibly 8.6 million people to come back and invest, now you're looking at, and I'm going to just, of course, you'd exclude miners or what have you. Now you're looking at 200 and something million people that can actually make the investment. There's no restriction upon that. So you've opened up your inventory of potential investors by, you know, exponential number.
But there's also another side to it. It allows other people to be able to invest in companies as well. It allows, you don't have to be super wealthy to be able to buy into a company or wait until they're on the stock market.
Well, not at all. And if you look at it in the past, for instance, if you just look at an IPO like Facebook, for instance, typically, unless you are a very well-known large client of the brokerage firm,
exactly,
you're not going to be offered shares of the IPO anyway.
So, unless you're in the know.
Right. So when your average person says, you know, hey, there's a new IPO deal coming up, I'd love to get involved with it. Well, you know, good luck. You'll be able to get involved with it the first day that it starts trading when it trades up 30-40% at the open.
Yeah. After they made their millions, then you can get involved.
Right.
Yeah. You're making them their millions. Get involved.
That's all. one of the perks of being there at the top.
Yes.
But you guys are right. Once equity crowdfunding is made legal on the federal level, then you'll have smaller investors that can participate in companies that might have a big rate of return in the future, which has usually been reserved for venture capitalists and angels. But until that's legal, you know, you can't do that. One of the tests the SEC looks at to verify that you have truly an accredited investor is the size and the amount of the money that you're raising from that person. Just the mere fact that you're raising $25,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 from one investor typically tells the SEC that you have an accredited investor without even seeing any verification. But you do have to verify now that they are an accredited investor. And just to kind of clarify, we're talking about what you can do now versus once equity crowdfunding is enacted.
When do you think equity crowdfunding will be enacted?
Well, you know, actually, it's yeah, that's a good question. People have been trying to answer that for a long time. A little over a week ago, though, the SEC published their agenda with respect to the upcoming rulemaking, and they set an October 2015 target date for certain Dodd-Frank and Jobs Act rulemaking. Specifically, though, that you know, the adopting the final rules regarding the offer and sale of securities through crowdfunding and adopting the final rules regarding amendments to, as Paul has been talking about, Regulation D and Form D relating to the 506 offerings. And that, of course, is referring to offerings in which the issuers engage in the general solicitation and advertising. So historically, you know, the SEC has not always met, and I say that not too lightly, but has not always met their target dates in their rulemaking agenda. So the October 2015 target should be considered basically a guideline other than an absolute deadline.
It's a sliding date.
Well, it's been a sliding date now for about 2 years.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's coming down the pike, right? And
it is now. There's too much pressure and this thing's going too far. And we can talk about that in a few minutes if you want to. But states are actually beginning to take matters into their own hands because they're tired of waiting. And so that's where, you know, we can talk about in a few minutes intrastate crowdfunding.
So, and when do you think that is there some legal places that you can do intrastate crowdfunding?
There are. Since, 2012, there have been 13 states that have passed new laws or changed their regulations to make equity crowdfunding available to, you know, generally to the masses. And the details on each state's rules are different, but the goal is always the same. It's to make it easier for startups of any type to raise money, even if they're, you know, in geographic areas without a strong base of angel or seed stage investors. And I think it was 2014, this year, Wisconsin became one of the first states to pass a law permitting interstate equity crowdfunding, and it allows Wisconsin businesses to sell shares of stock to Wisconsin residences, you know, through an equity crowdfunding website. And, you know, although it's heavily regulated because it is a securities offering, you know, the new law does provide startups another way to acquire funds for the exemption and to apply in Wisconsin, for example. Some of the requirements are that you must be organized and incorporated in the state, have a majority of full-time employees in the state of Wisconsin, have a principal office in Wisconsin, do the majority of your business in Wisconsin, meaning at least 80%, gross revenue 80%, you know, the list goes on and on. So the result of the interstate crowdfunding is a patchwork of rules and laws that vary, you know, wildly from place to place. But you now have Wisconsin, Michigan, Washington, Colorado, Texas, you know, there are several states out there now that have decided, well, 13 that have decided, you know what, we want to go ahead in the state of Alabama, my own home state, and they have a particularly odd rule, and some of these go outside what the Fed rule is proposing as far as the amount that can be raised per person.
But the state rules, right? So
they do, and they'll have to make the decision at some point as to whether or not, once it becomes legal as far as federally, they'll have to make the decision whether or not they want to change their own intrastate rules and go ahead and become in line federally, which I imagine that most of them will.
Well, so now the question is, if you don't live in a state where it's legal right now, can you fundraise from that state, or do you need to stay with just the equity? You have to stay with people who are verified or accredited.
Well, it's not just that, as I said, and you know, using Wisconsin as an example, you know, your company had to be organized and incorporated in the state, in that state. Okay, the majority of the employees have to be in that state, principal office in the state, 80% of the revenue in the state. So no, what's actually happening is, states are pretty much sealing off their borders to stop them from taking in any kind of outside state, which is why it's referred to as intrastate crowdfunding, outside state money. So it's a very personalized. I'm sorry?
That's because they can't, right? I mean, they can't. Their laws will only apply to them anyways.
That's correct, to their state. I mean, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the cannabis industry right now. While each state, and I think it's legal now in either 17 or 23 in some form or another, while each state is beginning to set their own guidelines and boundaries, there's still that overhanging federal law, and federally, the entire thing is illegal. But in the case of cannabis, the feds have decided that, you know what, and this was mainly with the Obama administration, we're going to stay out of this. We're not going to come in and start performing raids or what have you. We're going to let you deal with it on a state-by-state case basis and, you know, do your thing.
Yeah, well, this is a sidetrack, but I just saw on the news last night, there's a woman who was giving her teenage son, I think he was 15 or 16, cannabis. And so in my state of Minnesota, they are going after her hard for that. Whereas if she was in another state, it wouldn't matter.
Well, it's funny. Anytime there's a new industry, like we said, that comes out, you know, everyone's looking to Colorado, not to get too far off on the subject as the test, because Colorado is the first state to make it totally wide open as far as legal and not just for medical purposes. But my company, Universal Media Consultants, we did the first press release on the very first marijuana commercial to ever air on a major broadcast network. And that press release,
yeah.
Well, listen, it drew so much attention, both good and bad.
So you're hiding for cover.
Well, no, I mean, actually, you know, it's funny you say that. You know, typically on some of my press releases, the contact information would primarily be the company that the release was for. In this particular case, I made the mistake of putting my company information as primary contact. I was receiving, honestly, I'll bet you 40 calls a day from ABC, from the doctors, Dr. Oz. I mean, the list went on and on because people saw this as, hey, this is the first time in history that we're going to be advertising marijuana on national broadcast television.
But did you advertise it from a medical perspective? I know we're getting way off topic, but...
What we did, and you can still find
the
ad.
Can you do equity crowdfunding for marijuana companies?
Well, you can still find, funny you'd say that, that's lining up too, but you can still find the ad on YouTube or the video. But what ended up happening was, and I'm not going to mention names, even though there were legal letters where the actual commercial had been seen, money had changed hands and everything, and it was set to run only in markets that already allowed the sale of cannabis, the major broadcast company, which does control a large majority of your cable channels, decided that it was in their best interest to pull it, and they did immediately because
it's just too
controversial.
Yeah, it's a controversial topic, just like in our state where I was saying she was giving it to her son for medical purposes, but they're going after her hard. So it depends on how people feel about it. But let's get back into equity crowdfunding. So in reality, unless you're in a state and you have 80% of your revenues there,
that's Wisconsin only.
Oh, and Wisconsin. Okay.
Yeah. See, that's what I'm saying. That what you've ended up with is a patchwork of rules and laws that differ from state to state. So, you know, depending on what state you live in, which right now there's only like 13, can you even do it? So that is very, very limiting in what can be done. So right now, it is just a very small fraction of the overall public who's able to participate, and it's dependent upon which state you live in. That's why everyone is so excited, and they want to get to the bottom of this as quick as possible and get the SEC to get these rules out.
Well, it'll be exciting once it goes through. So in the meantime, you really want to find, tap into that 8.1 million accredited investors. How do you go about doing that?
In other words, how do you find the accredited investors?
Yeah.
Well, if you're going to take advantage of the new rule under Title II, which is the 506C that allows you to take money from people that you don't know, first of all, we've already gone over this. They have to be accredited, and you have to verify it. And the SEC gives guidelines on how to verify that you have an accredited investor. So you can now do general solicitation. So you can, for example, you know, put advertisements in newspapers, articles, magazines. You can have seminars. You can do solicitations on television and radio to be able to find accredited investors. Or there are several, I mean, lots. You just have to Google accredited investor sites where they have a population of accredited investors that have already signed in as investors, and you can post your opportunity up on the website. One of them that comes to mind is equitynet.com. Another one is earlyshares.com.
And how many members do they have?
I believe equitynet.com claims it has about 20,000 members. I've been on there a lot, and I think active at any particular point in time is 7 or 8,000. It's still a substantial amount.
So most do most companies that have a decent plan, is it fairly common that they can get funding?
Well, if you look on their website, it is self-fulfilling up there, but the companies will list their goal and how much has been funded so far. And it's kind of interesting seeing all the different type of industries up there, and I haven't really done an analysis to say, hey, tech companies are doing better than a food company, for example. I think it has a lot to do with the actual structure of the deal.
Well, that's an equity crowdfunding environment just with accredited. I mean, it's the same concept. It's just with people with more money.
Yes, but it comes with a little bit of a warning. What they do is they will pre-vet that accredited investor. They'll have them fill out that self-authenticating form, and then they'll research them on social media sites and determine if they feel it's an accredited investor or not. They're not going through the actual steps that the SEC suggests to verify, collecting financial statements or a third-party verification from, you know, an attorney or a registered investment advisor or a CPA or something along those lines that the SEC has put and suggested rules out of how to verify they're accredited. So it's very wise on the part of the issuer and the company that's raising money to go through that process anyway. Just because an equity crowdfunding site that claims to have all of these accredited investors has vetted them and has given them a password so only they can see the information that you're supplying, it's still best, according to several SEC attorneys that I've talked to, go through the process of actually verifying that you're talking to an accredited investor yourself. But could be a very good platform to raise money. People are doing it right now.
Well, and you know what, I think about this too. If you look at, you know, when we ran into the one-year anniversary of the Jobs Act Title II provision, you know, a total of 534 out of over 3,000 companies had successfully hit that equity crowdfunding target in year one. And that was totally, you know, thanks to Title II of the Jobs Act. Now, that being said, some people might look at that and think, well, you know, wait a second. You raised, I think it was $218 million or so dollars in equity capital, you know, averaging $400,000 a company. You know, that's not a very good successful rate. But the way I look at that is, you know, you're talking about having accomplished that in the very, very beginning before we knew what we know now. I mean, that to me, I look at that in an opposite way and think, you know, hey, that's a great sign of things to come.
Well, and if people who aren't used to investing, it's hard for them to get their head wrapped around it. So it's going to take time just like anything else.
Absolutely.
And you know, Sarah, you asked me that question about how many entrepreneurs, how many investors. So I pulled it up while we're talking here, equitynet.com, and they, right at the top toolbar, they have 31,000 and change entrepreneurs, which means companies that have posted opportunities, 20,000 investors. And since inception, and I don't recall, I think it was either 2005 or 2007 they've been doing this, $251 million raised.
Oh, it is happening
out there.
Well, and they might be in a position to really go after that market as well, those websites. those companies.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't be surprised to see them morph into, equity crowdfunding, offering non-accredited investors an opportunity to get involved in those opportunities as well.
Right.
Well, do you see, once this all goes through, do you see big players taking advantage of small investors?
You know, I in any industry like this, I mean, you're going to see that happen to an extent, and I think that's been what some of the fear has been in the beginning. I think the whole investment industry, though, is going to change. I mean, I'll give you an example. Paul and I have worked on a company called Buttonwood Equity Partners, and you know, you're going to have, as with the cannabis, and I hate to keep comparing it to that, but it's the only other large nationwide item that's come into effect that has such great ramifications upon the entire nation. Well, you know, I deal with, as I told you last show, I probably have 6 to 8 phone calls a day. In the older days, it was about people wanting the crowdfunding campaign management and the marketing and advertising for traditional rewards-based crowdfunding. Now, though, it's flipped over to where literally the majority of the calls are people wanting me to help them with their equity crowdfunding. Well, I started thinking about it. I called Paul and we said, look, why don't we do this? You know, out of all those companies I talked to, which if you look at the numbers, you know, I'm talking to 100 different people over the course of a few weeks. There are one or two in there that are so strong, and it's not a turnaround situation. It may simply be something where they want to expand and they can't get their hands on the money. I told Paul, I said, you know, let's set up a company where we go ahead and we fund the company with, I don't know, $4 to $6 million. And when that one or two companies come along, we tell the person, you know, look, let's do this. Let's bypass the equity crowdfunding in general. Let's do away with it.
Well, you guys should set up a middle market equity.
Well, that's kind of what we're trying to do by saying, okay, look, you know, you're going to have to go through a lot of hoops, and we could get into one of the things that's really going to shoot equity crowdfunding in the foot, and that's the cost. The cost involved with pulling it off due to all the requirements and constraints through the SEC can be prohibited to some companies. So I told Paul, let's do this. Let's set aside this fund when the right companies come across, and keep them out of equity crowdfunding. We'll go ahead and give them the money in exchange for an equity position in their company, and then we'll take it from there. We'll help them streamline. We'll put someone on the board, and in the end, we'll take them public in another 18 months or so.
Well, those are wonderful opportunities for you because, you know, when me talking to other people that are in that market, they're saying that there's a competition to a certain degree to find the good companies because there's so many people that want funding,
well,
but you know, there's only a limited amount of companies that really have the strong financials and
well,
everything.
Fortunately, that's not my issue because, as I said, having been in this for so long, I field so many phone calls a day that the companies are out there. It's just weeding through and getting to the companies that are good and that are worthy of it.
Exactly.
And, you know, this whole thing came about, and we started this conversation by saying that, you know, there are so many little cottage industry types that are going to come from this, and I hate to make this correlation once again to the cannabis industry, but as you know, one of the problems in that industry is that since it is illegal federally, banks are not allowed to transact money. So what's happened is you've got these cannabis companies out there that are moving millions of dollars a day in cash, and since they can't put it in banks, they're having to hire ex-Blackwater operatives and people like that with M16s and different security routes and all of that to transfer and move money on a day-by-day basis. Now, I bring that up because it's one more example of any time you have something as earth-shattering as equity crowdfunding or as cannabis being legal, you're going to find all types of offshoots of businesses that are going to pop up, that are going to try to fill a niche that, you know, can't be filled so far.
Yeah, it changes in that way, but what else do you think is going to change? How do you think this is going to fundamentally change our investment environment?
Well, I think that you're going to have an opportunity now that, you know, the crowd is going to be allowed to come in and start businesses. I mean, as Paul said, since 1934, I mean, we've not had anything as earth-shattering. I mean, when you talk about, if you think, there, in the business world, there's around 500,000 new businesses that get started each month. As unbelievable as that is. And, you know, funding those businesses comes from a variety of sources. And if you can't go out and rely on the bank, and especially after 2008 and 9 when we started to have that meltdown, and you talk about credit restrictions and things like that, you have to find other ways to do it. What's going to happen is the bank is no longer going to be your primary source of funding. You know, when you're a company or you're an entrepreneur, you're faced with several means of acquiring money. As Paul said, you go through family, friends, credit cards. Then you'd ideally like to take the money where it hurts the least, meaning your family, whatever. And then you'd go to the next best bet, which would be your bank. If you didn't qualify with a bank and you already had a business up and running, you may go to a factoring company that factors against your receivables. Well, that's a higher percentage rate. And, you know, if you really wanted to push this all the way down, although it doesn't apply, you would end up where your last resort would be to borrow money from a loan shark. So what you're doing here is you're opening up the door to borrow money from, you know, your mom and pop organizations or individual people. And instead of only having a small town with, say, three banks, now you've got the entire nation with 340 or 360 million people.
Well, couldn't you think, or wouldn't you think it would just create a flourishing effect with entrepreneurs and starting businesses, and it could just really help, you know, invigorate the new ideas and new technology and just get us going.
Well,
because there's been a drag on new businesses, and I know that there's a lot starting, but there's a lot of failures because they just don't have the funds and the means.
Yeah, but
you know, Sarah, I'm glad you mentioned that. One of the things I think is going to happen in the future is going to be similar to what's happening, let's say, the Shark Tank, for example, where the companies that are, let's talk about startups here because it more likely would occur with them, instead of just looking for capital and, you know, that it gets funded because they have a good business plan, good model, they might also be looking for advice, guidance, and education. And everything that Philip mentioned earlier as far as ways of garnering money, friends, family, credit cards, loan sharks, banks, none of them provide that, you know, advice, guidance, and education like they do on the Shark Tank.
Well,
those people
sharks,
are in there.
Loan sharks provide some education.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they do with a hammer, right?
That's right.
So they're looking, I think they're going to be looking for that advice and guidance that is provided. They're looking for partners with experience and connections like on the Shark Tank. And I think you'll eventually see something like that come along where, like Philip says, you have these other industries that will pop up to kind of help out the industry flourish.
And then you mentioned it bringing about more entrepreneurialism, and yes and no to that. And part of the reason is, you know, it's the same thing with, we go back to traditional or donation-based crowdfunding, in that, you know, typically people have an idea. When it's real easy for them to put their idea out there, and then they sit there and they twiddle their thumbs and they watch their actual crowdfunding campaign, and they wait on the money to flow in, and no money comes in, and they don't understand why. They think that, you know, I'm out there, I'm on Kickstarter, why isn't there any money? What they don't understand is the only money that's going to come in is the money that you bring in via advertising and marketing of your crowdfunding campaign.
It's the same problem that we talked about the last time, is that you
That's
still
right.
have to look at it as a campaign. You got to market it, you got to sell it. There's a big picture here.
Well, but what I'm saying, though, is you're right, and what I'm saying is you mentioned would it spark entrepreneurialism, and while you might think right off the bat that it may, what you're going to find out is dependent upon how hard the SEC ends up making it and how expensive that they end up making it for people to go out and equity crowdfund, you may find that it may have an opposite effect, and it may make the ones who are going to already go ahead and progress with their project stay away from equity crowdfunding and seek other means, which is why I go back to why, you know, Paul and I's idea of Buttonwood Equity Partners was such a great idea. You know, we'll bypass all of this. It's cost prohibitive and everything, and we'll just give you the money.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a wonderful opportunity for you, especially with how many businesses that you're talking to.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's a tremendous opportunity, and that's why it took a while for it to sink in. You know, I think after probably about the 10th company that I thought to myself, wow, you know, if I only had the funds to invest on my own, then, you know, this is a great idea. And then I started thinking, you know, you're sitting in a position where, like Shark Tank, you have people coming before you on a daily basis pitching their business. You should figure out a way to take advantage out of how to help them, make it easy for them, while at the same time make it very lucrative for you to be involved.
Absolutely. And you should get together with Mike McHugh, who I did a show with earlier. He has that middle market equity fund. He mm-hmm. might be interested in working with you as well. I don't know, but there's other big players.
Yeah, we've actually got a lot of people that are interested in it because, I mean, when you think about it, it's a situation where you can pick and choose. The important thing for us to do in the beginning was to establish an affiliated working group of professionals in every single sector, be it securities and exchange lawyers, all the way down to due diligence personnel, to people who specialize in IPOs, so that we had
Absolutely.
All of the bases covered. Once we had the company in line, we could run them through every single subcontractor or affiliated working group and make sure that it was going to turn out. In other words, we wouldn't have any surprises for the investor.
Oh, that's great. So it sounds like you got your act together. You're all the way up and down the line.
We've been doing this a long time.
Yeah, good for you guys. Well, that's why I'm interviewing you. I did research.
We're always happy to get out and discuss what we do.
Yeah, this is great. Well, is there anything else, any general advice that you would give people that are considering doing this?
I'd like to jump in here. Just one other thing I think that's kind of important here is whether you're a company looking to raise money now under the current rules and regulations that you can do it, or waiting for equity crowdfunding, you know, keep in mind if you're going to do it now, you're going to want to present the best terms you can to that investor to get them to invest, whether it's on an EquityNet site or one of the other many accredited investor sites that are out there. Keep in mind, accredited investors are sophisticated investors. Even it comes down to where we are doing equity crowdfunding late next year, the investors are going to pick out what they perceive to be the very best investment out there. You know, they make money by investing in companies with a proven revenue model or a proven management, at least if it's a startup. So due diligence is very important. So, you know, make sure that you have a well-defined business plan where when the investor is going to research your company, they have everything at their disposal in that business plan. Another thing is evaluation. You need to be able to come up, just like on the Shark Tank, you know, they're offering $200,000 for 10% of your company, right? That's a $2 million valuation. You have to know what your company is worth. So make sure you have a way of getting a business valuation done so that if you're looking to raise $250,000 and your company's valued at $2.5 million, you know you're going to offer 10% in equity. And that's going to be a fair valuation as opposed to something that's off the wall and is going to turn an investor away.
You have to know what they're looking for.
Exactly. And, you know, everyone's looking for an exit strategy, too. So the primary objective of every investor is eventually being able to get out of that investment at a good rate of return, at a much higher amount that they put into the company. So consider your exit strategies and how you're going to present those to the investors ahead of time. Before you allow them to get involved, because they're going to want to know that before they get involved. And one of the exit strategies that we do for our companies is we take them public onto the over-the-counter marketplace without the use of an expensive investment banker. It's called a self-underwriting, and it's much less expensive. And, you know, within 2 or 3 years of the initial investment, we typically have a company up and trading, and it allows for a potential exit strategy for our investors.
You know, I'll agree with what Paul said. I mean, number one is that, you know, we make these references to Shark Tank only because, you know, it is pertinent here and it does make sense. But when people come in there and they absolutely overvalue their company, then they have no chance of getting the funding or working it out. You know, fortunately,
they had a good idea. I mean, they just,
well, that's right. But listen, there are people who have been working on trying to figure this out long before most people knew it was a problem. I'll go back to Ruth Hedges, for example. She started Crowdfunding Roadmap a long time ago. And basically she had the insight to see, okay, if people are going to go out and raise money via crowdfunding, equity crowdfunding, they need some idea accounting-wise how to value their business, how to put their, and this is the second part that's most important, and that is their business plan, how to put their business plan together. Because while your equity crowdfunding is something new, you're still dealing with very old rules from the standpoint of what an investor wants to see before he makes a decision whether or not to put his money in. So a business plan is an absolute must. And she probably has the best one that I've seen to date.
Yeah, it's very good. And it's all in template form. It's electronic. So because, you know, a business should be changing their business plan as they morph and change. And this way you don't have to keep rewriting it. It's a nice template where you can change it as your business changes.
And you can just go get it?
You can do it online. I mean, it's actually crowdfundingroadmap.com.
Okay.
And you can see it online, how it works and everything. And she's been, you know, I can't say enough about her either, because she has been, in the beginning, she has been instrumental, and she's one of the first people that I met when I got into equity crowdfunding in pushing this through. She has devoted so much of her time and effort into this, and it's beginning to pay off for her in a big way. And, you know, if you talk about the business plan and how important that is, I mean, you know, it defines the whole purpose of the business or the project, how it's going to operate, the amount of capital that it needs, how the person is going to be rewarded or how they're going to benefit by investing in that company. I mean, these are all key ingredients that are necessary for a successfully funded campaign.
And so they just, if you have that information there for them, they don't have to ask those questions. They know, they feel comfortable. And the more you have that, the more they feel like you really have your act together.
Well, look, just because you're going out into the general population to solicit funds does not mean that you're going to be dealing with idiots when it comes to handing over their money as an investment. And I think that's one of the things.
That's a good point. You're going to be handing over you're probably talking to pretty smart people, because people who are even looking, especially early on, looking at investing tend to be a little more astute anyways.
Well, that's right. But, you know, once again, though, there we get into the issue with the SEC again, and whether or not, you know, that industry is going to be ripe for fraud. And certainly while it can be, I think this all boils down to that more generalized government question of, is an individual better capable of taking care of his own, you know, business and making his own decisions, or is the government better enabled to make those decisions for you?
And I the SEC is all about protecting the individual investor. So right now, what you can and can't do is, you can, if you're the company, you can go out and solicit only accredited investors, but you can't be compensated for it, and you have to make sure that you've never been sanctioned or found guilty of securities law violations.
That's actually the bad actors rule. And
the bad actors rule. Now, equity crowdfunding kicks in, Sarah, here's what's going to happen. You cannot go out as an issuer and directly solicit non-accredited investors. It's an important distinction. You have to do it through a pre-approved funding portal that's registered with a self-regulatory organization like FINRA. Mm-hmm. So you cannot just go out and solicit non-accredited investors through the means I've went over before. You have to do it through one of these pre-approved portals. It's a way to make sure that the investors are getting all of the information that they can get to make a reasonable decision of whether to invest in your company or not. That's what the SEC is all about, protecting the small investor.
I suppose at a certain degree, with how much fraud there has been, it's probably a good idea.
Well, it's going to happen. I mean, you know, you read about this on a daily basis. I saw an article that came across my desk the other day where, you know, they're going after an individual from a traditional donation-based crowdfunding campaign who basically just, you know, there's a non-existent product, did a great little mock-up and everything, and just basically tried to extort money from people or whatever you want to call it without any intention. You'd almost consider it a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, well, and we all know how those go down.
Yes, we do.
Well, he was the head of the, what was it, he was on the SEC board, wasn't he? Madoff?
Bernie Madoff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an interesting situation.
He was a big-time dude.
I hate to always hammer on the SEC, but I have my reasons. But, you know, back when that happened, they had been warned on numerous occasions.
Oh, five times, five or six
times. And they actually did look into it, and they never saw anything until it was too late. And what happened actually after that. It's really, it's not funny. It's kind of sad in a way. There was a knee-jerk reaction. They held a congressional hearing in which even members of the SEC that testified said that they had some serious problems and that they were not getting the job done the way that they should. And as a result of that knee-jerk reaction, they came out of that meeting and they went overboard in establishing small new groups and everything to go after microcap fraud and things. Well, when they did that, it's kind of like a witch hunt, so to speak, from the standpoint that, you know, now that... And then right after the Madoff thing, they missed the Sanford deal, which was another one that was just tremendous. So they were beginning to become accused of, you know, what are you there for if you're actually examining these books and you're looking at these companies and you're not seeing what's actually wrong?
Well, but the problem with that is that there's one thing about going in and not seeing it and you couldn't see it because they did a good job of hiding it. There's another thing when you have a whistleblower that's sending you the data, they're laying it out for you. They're walking you through it like you're a kindergartner and you still can't see it. That's when there's problems.
They went overboard in the other direction. You're absolutely right. But now they decided that they needed to go out there and they needed to try to reestablish some of their credibility by finding these situations. And unfortunately, some of the ones that they're turning, you know, on, which was the case of the banker last week where the court overturned the SEC, where they had said that, you know, this guy was responsible for fraud or insider trading, what have you. And in essence, they came back out and said, look, the SEC is abusing its power, that this was not the case. We cannot look at it like that. And they overturned it, and the guy got off, which is going to bring up a lot of appeals probably.
Was he a small guy?
No, and I can't recall the details of it. I scanned through so many things. It caught my attention, but I can't recall the details. No, it was a major deal. I mean, if you search anywhere in the Google or whatever, it'll pop up in the news. It's been a big deal for a while.
Okay, well, that's interesting.
Anyway.
It's another
Yeah, not to get off topic too much. But
well, you know, I thank you again, and people can get hold of you where?
Well, the easiest way is to contact me through my LinkedIn profile under Philip Cardwell, because there is where you will find, you know, especially at the top of crowdfunding, but there's where you'll find all the other links to how to contact me and telephone numbers. And, you know, I'll make sure and give you some information for your website and for Paul also. We're always available, though.
Okay, that's great. And so people need to get hold of you. They can just find you on LinkedIn and
that's
go from there.
That's the easiest way to do
or
it.
Or on
if not,
my radio page.
Yeah, if not, or your radio, or they can find me through crowdfundingaccelerator.com.
Okay.
So there's almost, if you just type my name out there, believe me, it's easy to get in touch with me. You'll find me.
Okay, well, great. Thanks so much.
Hey, Sarah, listen, I appreciate you having us back, and we'd love to come back anytime you want to discuss it further.
When this thing gets farther along, we gotta have you back.
Absolutely. We'd be more than happy to.
Okay.
Thanks, Sarah. It was great getting to know you.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Thanks, Phil.
You bet.
All right. Goodbye.
Yeah, bye. Are you there?
No. As you can see, equity crowdfunding is more involved than just putting a campaign up there on a site and expect people to come to it. It's very much like regular crowdfunding where you really need to think about the overall campaign. But on top of that, there will be rules and some hoops that you need to jump through. So it's important to understand the basics behind it and what the SEC is actually going to be expecting of people that go this route. So it's important to do your research, and I'm really hoping the SEC gets their act together and gets this through this fall as people are expecting. But if you want to do more research and you have more questions, please visit Philip Cardwell's website at www.crowdfundingaccelerator.com. He really has a lot of good information, as well as Paul Winkle of Alex Consulting. I think they will really help you on this front if it's something that you're serious about doing. But that's all I got to say today about this. So have a wonderful day and have a great New Year's.